Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining this webinar on the legal landscape for emergency preparedness and COVID response post-COVID-19. Really an honor and a privilege to have Professor James Hodge joining us for this webinar, and give his bio in just 1 second. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to join us for this webinar. If you do want to recommend this webinar to colleagues, please know that it will be recorded and archived on our website, rdhrs.org, and will be available for viewing either later today or by tomorrow. So if you can advance to the next slide, please. So although James is the lawyer and I am not, I have a couple of disclosures to offer. That the content from everyone speaking in this webinar is presented by the individual speakers only. And although our RDHRS Regional Disaster Health Response System grant is funded by the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the Department of Health and Human Services, no portion of this webinar reflects the official policy or position of ASPR or the United States government. None of the content of this webinar is meant to be a substitute for medical or legal professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And I won't read the entire rest of the disclosure disclaimer to you. But no information, obviously, in this presentation is meant to provide specific legal advice, and none of the speakers, myself included, have financial interests or relationships to disclose. So we can have the next slide. So again, my name is Paul Bittinger. I am the principal investigator and the medical director for the Region 1 Regional Disaster Health Response System program funded by ASPR, as I mentioned. This program is designed to help healthcare and public health institutions across the New England region, Region 1, improve their preparedness and response for major disasters of all types. We are very grateful for the presence and support of our ASPR Region 1 leadership here on the webinar with us today, and we're very grateful for the support from ASPR for the grant overall. I want to get right away to our content because we're so fortunate to have such a distinguished speaker with us today. Very, very excited to have Professor James Hodge, who is the Peter Kiewit Foundation Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University, and he is director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy. Through scholarship, teaching, and other applied projects, Professor Hodge delves into multiple areas of public health law, global health law, ethics, and human rights. Since 2010, he has served as a director of the Western Region Office for the Network of Public Health Law, which is one of 5 centers nationally that is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Since its inception, the office has assisted public health lawyers, officials, practitioners, students, and others across 11 states and nationally on over 4,300 claims. He's a prolific scholar in public health law and specifically expert in disaster public health law, having published more than 275 articles in journals of law, medicine, public health, and bioethics, 2 books in public health law, 25 book chapters, and has guest edited 4 symposium issues in the Journal of Law, Medicine, Ethics, Geriatrics, and the Annals of Health Law. So really, we can't ask for a better speaker to be joining us today. I'm so excited for his talk. This is relevant, certainly very much for our region here in Region 1. We know there are others joining from other ASPR regions, and I want to thank all of you for joining us, and I'll turn it over to James. Thank you so much.
Paul, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be able to join you here today. And listen, I'm just so excited about everything we've got to discuss and all of the various different material that we'll actually compress into our 30 minutes of discussion time. Very much looking forward to your questions and comments and thoughts that we'll address in real time toward the end of the session as well. Let me offer, if I may, first of all, special thanks and appreciation to my great colleague here in the Western Region Office, Jen Pyatt, who is actually one of our great attorneys, has done some of the scoping work you'll hear about during the course of this presentation. And I'm also delighted to be joined by Rebecca Freed. She's one of our fantastic, stellar law students here at ASU Law. She's a JD candidate, May 2022. She's with our Center for Public Health Law and Policy as a legal researcher. She'll be facilitating some of our questions and comments exchanges towards the end. Now, I'll invite you right now at any juncture, as Rebecca's monitoring it closely, if you've got a question, put it into the Q&A box and let us know that. She's monitoring for it, and towards the end of the presentation, we'll make sure to get to that. Now, without further ado, here's what we've crafted out for the purposes of our agenda today. And I'm going to actually do our best job in short order after going through quite a bit of material to make sure we cover each of these four major arenas. We're going to review the role of law in public health emergencies. Let's be really clear. We've lived through the most sensational public health event in U.S. history, period. And the role of law in relation to how we've responded to this in real time has been absolutely dynamic. We'll be playing that out with some early observations, and then we'll assess prominent federal and state emergency declarations, laws, and policies that have come out of the COVID pandemic. We'll just set the stage, basically, for then what we do in parts 3 and 4. Let's explore together what specific legal changes mean for public and private sector healthcare and public health services, particularly in emergency preparedness in Region 1 here for the purposes of future emergencies and disasters. Oh, we're not done with COVID-19 by any extent, but let's start projecting what we're learning in real time from this specific massive event that will actually play out for years to come. And then I'll hopefully identify some additional challenges for legal reforms in the 21st century. Now, without further ado, we're going to go through a good amount of material in real time. As Paul noted, the presentation is being recorded. We're looking forward to sharing that through our DHRS website. The slides that you're going to see, fully available to you later as well. But if you want, I can revisit any slide that you'd like during the course of our Q&A as well. All right, let's jump right into it. Without further ado, let's review the role of law in public health emergencies. This part just sets the stage for us without question. How big has COVID-19 been globally in the United States? The numbers don't lie. But there's something on screen that tells you just how big it's been in the United States on the global arena. The global cases are enormous, obviously. Deaths now approaching 4 million. In the United States, approaching 600,000, although inching up ever so slightly each day instead of by leaps and bounds. Statistically, just what we've experienced in regards to a pandemic of this nature and caliber in the United States. Listen, the U.S. stats don't lie. 19% of all global cases right here in the United States. 16% of all deaths, though lowering as a percentage in the United States, all within the U.S. as far as a global number. What's so telling? We hold 4% of the global population and yet comprise 16% of all deaths. We've got a lot to learn legally about how we're going to respond to events of this magnitude, but along the way, there's several different techniques and things we'll actually comprise within this presentation for future changes to come to make sure we never repeat this performance in the U.S. First and most importantly, let's be really clear about what I see in the role of law in emergency preparedness and response. Listen, whether you're medically trained or trained from a public health perspective, you've felt and seen the sort of role of law definitively in this event and prior events that you've experienced in the United States. Laws flat out define what constitutes an emergency. It's laws that will actually tell us that's when we declare emergency. And we've seen that across the federal government, state governments, tribal, local. They authorize the performance of emergency responses. Sometimes they actually stop us from doing things as well. We'll get to that theme. They assign responsibility for potential or actual harms that may arise. Laws are critically involved with that. The liability factors underlying it will be a big part of our discussion today. Laws actually create the infrastructure for how we're going to address and prevent emergencies going forward. And a lot of the legal reforms you'll hear me talk about are how to make sure, again, we stop these types of issues in their tracks going forward in the United States long term, both on the sort of mega scale, the macro scale, and the micro scale, what happens within each state or even each locality. All of these types of issues legally, plus a lot more I could display on screen, but these really capture a lot of our attention, all have core law and policy facets. Issues of access to everything from medical treatment to crisis-related care to issues related to vaccines. What the standard of care will be during these emergency events, you know laws dictated that in so many ways. I'll demonstrate it a little bit later. Public health powers. What can we actually do in real time to respond to events of this magnitude? That's been played out through legal authorizations at the federal, state, tribal, local levels, social distancing, privacy-related repercussions, civil rights norms, liability factors, always a specter underlying any emergency preparedness and response efforts, and waivers. When can we actually engage in waivers of specific maneuvers or legal laws and policies as we go forward? So critical as well. What you've got to know, and you've seen, I think if you've experienced all these types of legal concerns, is what we're always at work towards. We're always balancing. We're always trying, in a state of emergency, to appropriately find that right balance between individual interests that underlie these emergency response efforts, the sort of things that Americans really are quite vocal about, the things they don't tolerate well, like religious freedoms that are infringed, or issues related to equal protection violations, bodily and informational privacy concerns, due process. We're always balancing that against community interests in these emergency events. What and how far will we go with surveillance? How far and how extensive should vaccination campaigns and or mandates be? What and to what extent will we use isolation and quarantine authoritatively in a particular jurisdiction? What about closures, curfews, all of the social distancing mechanisms that really, in the end, flat out save lives in emergencies like COVID-19? They're all balanced against these specific interests. Hey, reaching that balance is not easy. It's never been easy. And the way in which we accomplish that in a real-time event is what I like to call legal triage. Now, listen, medical doctors like Paul, they'll talk a lot about medical triage. I have great respect for what doctors can do in real time to make those critical decisions. Lawyers are doing something similar. Law and policymakers are actually consistently working to actually find and build that sort of favorable legal environment in these emergency events. And we're doing it by prioritizing issues and generating hopeful solutions that facilitate legitimate public health responses. That's legal triage at its essence. Anybody not engaged in that specific sort of maneuvers during these emergency events obviously are coming up with legal impediments or barriers or other concerns. Now, we found that we have solutions to all of those particular issues in so many cases, but you've got to be prepared to do these five things, working in conjunction with lawyers and policymakers. First, assess and apply and monitor changing legal norms. Emergency declarations, as you'll see consistently, change the legal landscape. You've experienced that during COVID-19, and how they change is a critical part of how we respond to legal triage. You've got to identify legal solutions. That's not enough, though, just because you know a legal issue. Find the solution. And by that, I mean, if you're working with attorneys or lawyers on these specific issues, their job is to find a legal solution to perpetuate what we're trying to accomplish from a public health end. We explain those legal conclusions, hopefully in ways that make great sense for the non-legal practitioners and persons working on the front lines, collaborate with public and private sector partners. This is legal triage sort of demonstrated in this timeline. This is really what's going on. What we're trying to do through legal triage in practice is exactly what you're seeing on screen. How do we go from the tempest to the calm? How do we actually go from that moment where all of these swirling issues in regards to the early COVID-19 response efforts actually become legally clear, legally possible, and perpetuating a public health objective that we all agree toward as a community? How you actually transcend from the tempest to calm is what legal triage is all about. And let me assure you, these skills are not easy, nor am I about to suggest that we've accomplished this on any given occasion. But that's our goal, and that's what we're working towards through legal reforms ahead as well. Let's assess some of those prominent state and federal emergency declarations, laws, and policies that have come out of this pandemic that we've seen in real time, and let's just make sure you understand why this issue of legal triage is so critical. First of all, be conscientious of what you've actually witnessed and seen during the course of the COVID pandemic. It's unprecedented. There's no other word to describe it. We've never seen before in the history of the United States simultaneous declarations of emergency at every level of government across all different divides for the same common cause, stop COVID-19 in its tracks. What you see at the international, federal, state, and local levels truly is unprecedented. At the federal level, initially, of course, it was Secretary Azar issuing his national public health emergency through HHS. That's now been since renewed five subsequent occasions, most recently in April of this year. And to be sure, probably will be renewed several more times as well for 90-day stints. This initial emergency did some really key things in early January, late January, as you saw right after WHO declared what we have, of course, is a public health emergency of international concern. This specific emergency helped immensely, at least setting the tone for states, but it did take additional emergency declarations, all of which is still in place in regards to what President Trump did in regards to his it's March 13th, Stafford Act emergency, his National Emergency Act declaration, the Defense Production Act invocation. All of these specific emergency declarations authorize a bevy of federal powers that didn't have to be used, but could be used in real time. How we've used those effectively and transcended that into the Biden administration has been a big part of what we've seen in response to COVID-19 systematically. But here's the real picture that all of you all experienced across every state. That is every single state in some formal declared emergency. Now, you can look at the Northeast region of the Region 1 and realize, obviously, we're still in all of those declared states of emergency. But at one point, all 50 states did a simultaneous emergency declaration for months on end. That's never before happened in the United States. Today, at this point, six states actually no longer remain in the declared emergency. If you're wondering which of those six states are in alphabetical order, it's Arkansas, Michigan, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Wisconsin for various different reasons. Why would I highlight that specific fact? Because it's coming to Region 1 at some point or another. Soon, some state will withdraw from that emergency declaration. We're watching this systematically. Why is that so important? Because of this. This is what those emergency declarations authorize governors and others to do. The types of things you're seeing on the left side of your screen, the capacities to actually engage in major emergency planning, implication of ICS, use of isolation quarantine powers, the implication of licensure reciprocity to allow doctors and others to transcend borders, price controls over gouging, surveillance and reporting efforts, travel restrictions, waiver suspensions, all of this tied to these emergency declarations. When you rescind these sorts of powers are at threat as well. They can rescind automatically. That includes core liability protections as well. So how we actually responded in real time to emergency events when there's no longer a declared formal emergency legally becomes very interesting. You've seen the most systematic major federal legislation in response to any public health event ever declared and ever passed across different administrations in U.S. history as well. The Families First Act back in March 18th, the CARES Act in March 27th, other additional acts, the Paycheck Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act on April 24th, three systematic bills introduced and passed by Congress during the Trump administration did legally things you've never seen before, like requiring private health plans to actually provide COVID-related tests at no cost, providing volunteer healthcare workers total liability protections depending on where and how they actually serve within the administration or within specific fronts, additional funding for hospitals and healthcare providers, systematic, extensive funding capped by President Trump's signing of the Consolidated Appropriations Act in 2021. Oh, it did a lot. As you know, it's the biggest stimulus package in history at the time. But to be sure, one of the neat things it did that we all started to see and how it played out across various different arenas is expanded Medicare access to mental health services via telehealth. One of those initiatives from a telemedicine perspective we are seeing percolating across CMS for months on end, expanded that access to mental health services, paying dividends long-term for what and how we respond to an event of this magnitude. You see, in regards to the inception of the Biden administration, his introduction of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, this is an enormous piece of legislation, a $2 trillion package signed by President Biden, all of which lays out specific allotments of billions of dollars to Americans directly, of course, in the stimulus checks that were also done through the Trump administration. But then later, as you see down the screen there, look at all the direct resources laid out in the American Rescue Plan Act specifically for emergency response and preparedness in regards to COVID-19, but also for some of what we can do to rebuild how we respond to these issues going forward. Fascinating outlay of resources, and we're not remotely done yet. What President Biden has introduced in his 2022 budget gets even more interesting. He's directly laid within the budget itself a specific passage on how we'll confront the pandemic and rescue the economy simultaneously. And the outlay of resources in relation to that, as ASHTO, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, is on, as laid out nicely in their legislative alert, includes millions of dollars in new what we call flexible funding built within the budget proposal for core public health infrastructure. Yeah, the sort of stuff we failed to invest in over the last 20 years. Now, back in the budget, that's interesting to see how we actually use those funds as authorized within the proposed budget to improve readiness for the next public health crisis, front and center. How we will actually address topical issues that have been on display to horrendous arenas in regards to racial disparities and healthcare overall and how that has played out, a direct target of President Biden's fiscal 2022 budget. A fascinating series of developments of topics that weren't getting sufficient attention before COVID-19's changed the legislative game around that. Now, just because we're talking legislation, let's not lose sight of another key development, and that is the litigation trends. COVID-19 has basically led to thousands of different types of cases and lawsuits filed for a whole multifarious different variety of reasons. To date, we've seen about 10,600 total complaints filed across the United States and various different complaints by states, California, namely Texas, you see New York, big population states. But to be sure, what you're seeing within this litigation are a lot of different specific changing norms. And I highlight them because what we've seen directly and what you can do in emergency response stemming from all of the specific various different cases has really been quite fascinating. So what you're seeing on screen here are those sorts of opportunities we've seen for courts to assess in real time various judicial challenges to what we had to do to engage in direct social interventions to prohibit, to limit to the full degree possible COVID-19. In other words, social distancing maneuvers, closing various different businesses, all the things that were done in emergency preparedness and response lawfully were severely challenged. Courts took on two basic approaches. Some of them looked at those constitutional-oriented challenges and attempted to rebalance what they assessed as the constitutional norms. So they would actually assess the shifting nature of rights and emergencies. They balance alleged infringements against government sort of compelling interests, all of which everyone agrees was compelling in what was done in response to COVID-19 early on in March all the way through this period of time. And they would actually look at that and try to make great assessments on what would be constitutionally viable. You saw that in a case out of Maine at Bailey's Campground versus Mills, where the court says explicitly, when one weighs competing interests during emergency events like what we see with COVID-19, the presence of a major public health crisis is a very heavy weight indeed. And it actually goes on to say how scientific uncertainties about what will or will not be the best response as allayed by a governor or by a local health official got to give leeway to err on the side of caution. In other words, let's utilize some constitutional principles to allow these mechanisms to go forward despite very clear infringements on individual liberties. That's a neat approach, but contrast that with constitutional set-asides on the right side of the screen. Select courts actually determine whether specific rights could essentially be set aside during the entire course of the emergency. So as you saw in the case Binford versus Sununu, Governor Sununu in New Hampshire, where a court basically said in an emergency situation, fundamental rights may be temporarily limited or suspended. This got the ire of the New Hampshire legislature. They actually introduced a bill to make sure that type of decision would never happen again. That bill stands in abeyance, mind you, but it's an interesting development. Which and how might these courts disagree on specific issues became a major factor during the throes of the emergency. And let's not forget about the influence of the Supreme Court, who, in the course of 8 months, went from all but agreeing with California in regards to First Amendment free exercise of religious interests, abating potential closure of church-related and other religious-related enterprises for a period of time. The court on May 29th in what's known as South Bay 1 basically agrees with California state health officials. We do and should allow you the opportunity to keep those churches and other congregations closed. To be sure, at that juncture, that was what we thought might be a firm and settled opinion of the court. Come along several months later, the day before Thanksgiving, Roman Catholic Diocese versus Cuomo, where the court in a New York decision made and affirmed with new Justice Amy Coney Barrett in place, striking down an actual New York City provision that would actually keep those specific types of enterprises of religious nature closed for certain sizes, rejected it as a violation of free exercise interests, which just months later, the court in the same basic case, South Bay 2, with the same basic plaintiff, enjoined California from enforcing basically the same ban. In a course of 8 months, you saw the court change its gears completely on First Amendment free exercise interests with significant outlay of what and how far this would impact what we do in real time to respond to emergency preparedness and response for the limiting COVID infection. Fascinating development, and I dare say we're not done with the U.S. Supreme Court and its influence in this arena as well. Let's explore those impacts. We'll be brief here. One of the things that could happen in a webinar of this nature is I could go on various different topics for quite an extensive period of time, like the ones you're seeing on screen, and demonstrate just how each one of these will be severely changed due to COVID-19 going forward for the next decade ahead. What I'm going to do is be brief, though, and highlight specific changes that we're seeing, all of which will play out in how we actually deliver emergency preparedness response post-COVID, but also will play out in how we deliver healthcare services right now in the United States. Let's be brief on health insurance, disability protections, telehealth-related initiatives, drugs and vaccines, liability protections, and to be sure, health equity and disparities. And as a nice reminder, I'm seeing a few questions already start to percolate. Hey, embed them right into your Q&A or chat functions. Rebecca's monitoring for those, and we'll look forward to those in just a few moments. Let's take these on very briefly. But let me highlight just a couple of neat things, because this is the sort of stuff, again, that could dominate the rest of our session. But when you're looking at the types of core legal reforms that have stemmed out of this COVID-19 pandemic, start with health insurance benefits and just realize what's happened during the course of COVID-19. First of all, you saw Congress authorize things it's never authorized before, some of which appears within the Families First and CARES Act, requiring insurers to actually cover these COVID tests and services at zero cost to beneficiaries. When has that ever been doled out by Congress? Not anytime recently. And in part two there, an unbelievable development where actually Congress allowed states to dictate to ERISA plans, those plans that are governed by employers, about what they will have to do to respond to emergencies. If you know anything about ERISA, generally states can't touch those plans. But during COVID-19, for that limited duration, they did have the capacity to dictate to employer-sponsored plans what they were going to cover or not. I like the new report that just came out of HHS momentarily or earlier this week, actually, reporting 31 million Americans now have health coverage directly through the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. That's a record. We've never seen more persons in the United States covered directly through the exchanges and ACA in its history, over 12 years now. But the ACA, you probably know, is still under threat by the Supreme Court, and which could issue a decision at any point in time in California versus Texas nullifying the ACA. Do I predict that? No. Does anybody else? No. But does the court show a capacity for some rather surprising decisions like in its Supreme Court or in its First Amendment jurisprudence? You bet. We'll wait for that decision soon and see where that takes us. Issues related to disability protections, profoundly changing. Why? Because what you saw COVID-19 expose in regards to disability interests and rights, from the implementation of crisis standards of care to other specific arenas across the entire sort of disparate impact issues related to what and how we responded to COVID-19, has been absolutely sensational. Disability interests will flat out change post COVID-19. We're already reassessing issues related to how we're going to actually implement crisis standards of care based on disability protections. That's a big change, and we're working on that through the national academies as we speak. Issues related to the mental health impacts that we've hardly begun to gauge nationally in regards to months of social isolation substantiate additional legal reforms, some of which Congress is working towards as we speak. Telehealth, well, welcome to the new arena of how we deliver health care in the United States thanks to a pandemic. Telehealth has been completely and entirely reformed from top to bottom as a major tool for intervention from a healthcare public health perspective, and it will go forward in the next century to come. Why? Because it's proven its worth, and Congress finally caught up to it as an effective technique, especially in emergencies, CMS endorsing and allowing for regulatory waivers to make that possible. So extensive. The efficacy of telehealth services long-term, we may not be fully able to assess, but legally, I'm telling you, going forward, you're going to have opportunities for telehealth services being a major component of emergency preparedness and response ahead. Drugs and vaccines, I hardly need to tell you just exactly what's happened during this pandemic that has completely reformed what FDA's role will be and how quickly we can go from start to finish in authorizing specific vaccines. Not approved yet, but working towards it through Pfizer and other applications. This has been a seminal change in FDA policy. Its feet-dragging relation to how quickly it can actually respond has been completely revolutionized. Yeah, it got some political pressure during the Trump administration to make it happen, and it's received some additional pressure from outside forces to make it happen, these authorizations for vaccines and other medical countermeasures. But let's be sure, it has authorized multiple vaccines that are proven safe, efficacious, and are taking us out of the COVID pandemic thanks to a very substantial series of reforms and anticipation of additional ones to come within FDA on the national level, and then liability protections. It all boils down to this for so many practitioners, doctors, nurses, the hospitals that host them. When you're involved in a COVID-19 response effort or you're a member of a DMAT team trying to actually respond in real time, this always worries you about what and how you may be held liable in regards to what will be unconventional care or atypical medical services in the throes of an emergency. you want to find yourself under that umbrella of liability protections. And let me assure you, COVID-19 has expanded that umbrella systematically through federal protections like expansive interpretations of the PREP Act, allowing for just virtual liability protection for any medical countermeasure, including vaccines, and so many other specific measures showing up in federal bills, state bills, including within our region here in the region one, so many different protections already in place, additional legislative proposals in place to expand some of those liability protections as well. Listen, whether you fit under this umbrella has become easier to find, but identifying that you fit under it for emergency preparedness purposes going forward, still so critical. And then finally, on this particular topic, before we grab our last one and look forward to Q&A here in just a moment, health equity and disparities. I think we all know the one thing coming into the pandemic was we had some serious issues in the United States with health equity. Now, that's been exposed by the pandemic, I think, beyond anything we could imagine. The revelations that COVID-19 has shown us in regards to health disparities tied to multiple barriers to healthcare access, support, pure issues of racism has shown up in so many different facets and are now getting prominent discussion in medical journals and other places. All the interesting issues around what we've seen there recently, just been profound. The racial disparities resulting in disproportionate COVID death rates raise the prospect of new claims, claims grounded in constitutional parlance, claims grounded in civil rights related issues. The Biden administration has made it quite clear. Resolving health disparity and inequity issues going forward is a 21st century objective. Legally, we're going to have to figure out how that's done. And legally, the Biden administration seems ready to start proposing a lot of how that's done with new task forces and new panels. Did you see in the New York Times coverage just today, though, exactly what happens when you have this level of sort of racial disparity? It's not just about COVID-19. FEMA's outlay of resources in response to hurricanes and other specific events. When you look back on that over time, you see just gross disproportionate benefit allocations based on race. Nothing more based on race following natural disasters. These are fixable legal problems, and I think you're going to see them fixed in the next 10 to 20 years ahead as we work toward health equity as the new initiative. All right. Those are some of the topical things that are changing before you. Like I said, I could go on more extent there, but let's examine additional forthcoming 21st century legal reforms based on critical lessons learned. Now, do you remember this picture that I showed you a little bit earlier in the legal triage arena? Remember the sort of tempest storm, the storm that we all felt we were in back in March 2020? Probably may still feel like you're in. Oh, there's good reason to feel that way legally, because what Jen Pye and I have identified, along with our great network for public health law colleagues in response to what we call the COVID counterpunch, is that we're seeing now, after the fact, after we've assessed and utilized literally every public health emergency powers we can from a legal perspective, all designed to save lives in real time, we've seen state legislatures and a little bit on the federal side too engage in some counterpunching. What does that type of legislation look like? This on screen from multiple different states. Look at the sort of themes that state legislatures are working on as we speak presently in the United States, some of which have already been passed, some of which have been passed over vetoes of governors, like in Ohio with Governor Mike DeWine. These sorts of measures that are designed to clamp down from a state perspective on the sort of legal authority to engage in public health emergency preparedness. Yeah, it's actually pretty surprising, isn't it? In response to COVID-19, the most sensational public health event in history, some state legislatures want to authorize government to do less going forward, or to do it under a microscope of legislative authorization. I'll highlight just a couple things on screen. For example, in Florida, a bill introduced, currently still percolating, requiring localities to prove that any public health emergency measures that would deprive or even remotely be considered depriving people of constitutional rights or liberties must meet what we call strict scrutiny. Here's a judicial standard I can assure you you generally don't meet, because it's impossible to meet it in regards to a full-time, real-time event related to public health emergency response. It's tough. And if that Florida bill is passed, it's trying to dictate to courts in that specific state, you will apply strict scrutiny to those assessments. Fascinating. You got all of these different bills all trying to set legislative oversight committees to actually dictate to governors, to local officials, how they'll respond in real time, abating or basically nullifying their emergency responses if the legislature finds it inconsistent with their political ends. It's amazing the amount of legislative proposals out there designed to counterpunch in response to what public health authorities have done. And mind you, if you think Region 1's not listed on screens, we're in great shape. No, actually working with Rebecca, we found several examples in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island of bills currently pending, although I make no statement whatsoever that any of these bills will survive, you know, the legislature within their respective houses. But I will say, look at what these bills are trying to do. You know, requiring in Maine the governor to convene the legislature if a declared emergency exceeds 30 days, literally to ask the legislature, can we please go forward with more emergency-related powers? Gosh, you can't imagine how that would clamp down on what the governor could do in the future. In New Hampshire, a joint legislative emergency executive order oversight committee. We will literally watch you, governor, in regards to what you do, and we will tell you when you've gone beyond what we consider lawful or otherwise. Ah, unbelievable. A 30-day limit on emergency declarations in Massachusetts. Not terrible, but just requires the governor to consistently go back and have to reaffirm what an emergency means. And mind you, a lot of states already do that currently. Rhode Island, single 30-day renewal of an emergency declaration without a joint resolution. In other words, if the governor of Rhode Island wants to renew an emergency, if that bill passes, she's got to actually go back to the General Assembly and ask for a joint resolution. That's going to take time. People are going to lose lives based on that in a COVID-19 event. That sort of measure goes forward. Interesting, this counterpunch. Now, you're saying, like a lot of people in the public health legal arena or the public health preparedness arena, oh, no, this looks bad. In fact, this feels bad, all of these state legislative initiatives. I say wait one second. Hold your horses, because what's important here is to recognize we're not playing checkers anymore. The game's changed. We're playing chess now. And what I mean by that is just the same moment these state legislatures are playing checkers in regards to these legislative bills, we're playing chess on a national scale. And what that means is the game changed big time. You've seen it with the introduction of President Biden and Vice President Harris's administration. Beating this pandemic, as President Biden notes, will be the most difficult operational challenge we've ever faced as a nation, but he got elected on a platform to do it. And to be sure, introduced a national strategy for how to accomplish that in the first day since, you know, his inauguration, that laid out comprehensive goals, these being the domestic goal along with a seventh global health goal, all of which entail significant legal interventions unused previously by the federal administration. They're playing chess in regards to what they're legally authorized to do at the federal level. As noted, the game's changed. What you're really seeing is major strategic changes in approach. What states have been willing to do potentially pursuant to these machinations around the political elections is, first of all, shift some of that responsibility for testing, screening, masks, vaccinations, treatments, travel, what and how we restrict it, shift it to the federal level. And in return from the feds, they're going to get better science, better guidance, better data, best practices, new funding, and I'm talking billions of dollars of funding funneled into states due to this new strategic change in approach. And that means we're seeing significant new strategic legal responses at the federal level. Powers available to the feds that will preempt a good portion of what you're seeing states play around with related to national security interests, the federal preemption powers, issues around interstate commerce powers at the federal level that are supreme, federal spending conditions, the feds have the capacity to do that any day they want and are utilizing it more consistently, constitutional violations the feds can raise and win on in relation to some of those state machinations, emergency waivers, executive actions, all of this available for the purposes of what and how we might be actually changing the legal landscape long term. Now, listen, I'm not trying to say states are out of this game. Oh, they've got some cards to play, too. They can engage in non-cooperative federalism. They can not play along. And some states are showing us that. I don't necessarily see that in Region 1, but some states are showing us they're not willing to play along even to the detriment of the health of their populations. They're engaged in public health sovereignty. They're actually refuting spending power limits. You've got real issues around allocations that we talked to. These legal challenges around disability discrimination, age discrimination, equal protection, Eighth Amendment issues, all at play, all of which states can raise, all of which are being sort of refuted in regards to how far we might go in the full extent and breadth of what federal authority may mean here. We've got issues around mobilizing personnel. These might be the most profound for our preparedness purposes in the near future. How we actually respect and engage in cross-state licensure, what and how we actually assess the scope of practice of what state licensed officials can do. What will be the future standard of care pursuant to crisis long term? How are we going to assess the liability of all of these medical and other practitioners in real-time events? All of it sort of at play. All of it with state interests at play for sure, and some of it of which the feds can't control completely, but I'll assure you they've got their various different threats and they're using them quite neatly for how they actually can work and respond to these issues in real time. And then enforcement mechanisms is our last issue. And again, noting, be sure to make sure to share your questions in the Q&A or the chat function there. Rebecca monitoring them in a moment. The enforcement mechanisms at the federal level have become quite interesting. You've seen CDC use its existing powers to engage in moratoriums of rent-related expectations. Those could be expanded systematically, and I dare say will. OSHA has regulatory reforms among many federal agencies that have supreme authority over a lot of what you may see contrary to state level and mandates. We've got the capacity in regards to what and how we actually implement mandates around vaccines or otherwise to change that game going forward as well. Listen, all of these legal issues you're seeing on screen are at play in the 21st century emergency legal preparedness arena, but all of them are about how we actually play chess in an arena where saving lives is the premier outcome. Now, with all of that said, I hope some of that's very clear. I'm looking forward to questions, comments. Let me turn it over to Rebecca for the initial thoughts, and thank you for your attention throughout. So, Rebecca, I see we've got about 15 minutes or so. What sort of questions are percolating now among our audience?
Yes, thank you, Professor Hodge. Is my audio coming through for you okay?
It sure is. We're hearing you very well. Thank you.
Wonderful. So we've gotten some great questions in advance that I'll ask first. So Professor Hodge, what happens legally in states that are no longer in a declared emergency when we remain in a national public health emergency?
Yeah, I think that question is so critical because you saw earlier that slide where I demonstrated those six states or so that are already withdrawing from their emergency declarations in the midst of still a very significant pandemic. What does that actually mean? Well, it means that some of those powers that we've displayed and illustrated will not be fully available to those states as they go forward. Now, their governors are making critical decisions, or frankly, in some cases, their courts are dictating to Michigan and Wisconsin authorities what and how far the emergency declarations can go. But the ramifications on a state basis are profound and may show up in the region very soon. But to be sure, it does not dictate to the feds what is possible in emergency response at that level. So nationally, the federal government seems intent on remaining within those states of emergency, as noted that President Trump initially issued. None of those rely on state-based emergency declarations for the purposes of implementing the types of powers. In fact, states can still agree to emergency-related measures at the federal level, whether they're in an emergency at the state level or not, and still gain the protections of liability and other specific issues, notwithstanding the fact that they may have already rescinded from those emergency declarations. It seems a little more of a political ploy in some of those jurisdictions, like they're trying to finally say to their populations, hey, we're out of the woods in relation to COVID-19. That's dangerous territory. But to be sure, legally, we still have lots of options. It's just a matter of how we play those out as more of those states start to actually disband those emergency declarations. Seeing how that changes the legal landscape going forward, it's going to be a big-time summer objective. Rebecca, good stuff. What else are you hearing?
Thank you, Professor Hodge. So another question that we have for you is, what are some of the long-term legal implications of classifying COVID-19 as a disability?
That, to me, is a neat and important observation and question that we've got to start to think through. Now, listen, COVID-19, as you all know, because I'm not about to display, you know, the medical facets of what and how extensive the infection can be, but the long-haul cases and other specific arenas around COVID-19 suggests that it could easily be classified as a disability long-term, which means you're going to see disability protections around everything from how we treat those patients to employment-related issues and otherwise. That's the easy call. But the tougher stuff will be just exactly how we actually sort of classify persons who have experienced COVID-19 or otherwise, whether they're viewed as disabled, even in asymptomatic format. We've seen some states like New York make it quite clear they see any COVID infection as disabling, and that, to be sure, may be the right call, but we've not yet seen that fully effectuated across national boundaries, and to be sure, we've got more to explore about how far and how deep disability protections may extend. This becomes particularly interesting as we proceed forward in regards to how further emergency powers respond in real time, when and how we may have to implement crisis standards of care and limited outbreaks of COVID-19 because we can't clamp it down completely in particular jurisdictions. We've already seen HHS, the Office of Civil Rights, literally dictate back to several states the exact sort of disability discriminatory measures that were showing up in their own crisis standard of care plans. To be sure, how that plays out nationally over the next several months ahead, we're going to learn a lot from and need to reflect in better policy as we go forward. Rebecca, I'm really glad you asked that question because I think that's going to be a minefield for some of how we actually address future infectious disease threats in the you know, next 10 years ahead. Great stuff. What else you see?
Absolutely. Thank you, Professor Hodge. So another question I have for you is, what kinds of future changes should we anticipate in drug or vaccine approval and allocation processes?
Got it. So critical. And that one particular slide I may get back to in a second here in relation to what we are showing on screen there. With a little bit of luck, maybe I can find it here just for us so we can actually see what we're talking about on that side of it. Listen, I think one of the most important things about what you're seeing on screen is what and how quickly we've reformed drug and vaccine approval, that is authorization processes going forward. The use of emergency use authorizations through FDA, though again, politically undermined to some degree in regards to just how much pressure was put onto the agency and how it in many ways resisted that pressure quite successfully. But just what it means going forward in regards to authorizations is going to be profound. I think, for example, we already knew going into COVID-19 that EUAs, or emergency use authorizations, were kind of being used already over its sort of 6 or 7 year history as a sort of early test market within FDA. In other words, we're seeing some companies actually want to put up to FDA authorization through an EUA process to just get its particular product onto the market for the purposes of assessing whether it has utility in response to Ebola or response to other specific issues, and we've seen that used quite successfully. COVID-19 vaccines obviously changed that game considerably. So we had to go through a process in real time of assessing these specific vaccines. We saw some succeed, obviously through Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, through Moderna, and some fail, AstraZeneca and others not yet receiving that level of authorization. What does it mean? I think it means long term that we're going to see expedited FDA-related authorization processes become even more refined, authorizing specific things onto the market with greater sort of pace so that we can test them to a degree. There will be some risks along the way, but the benefit side of this has been so profound that FDA's ability to actually move in real time in response to COVID-19 with all the different federal resources underlying it and support for those vaccines has been monumental. I see future approval processes speeding along at a different clip. And I see the potential for FDA to at least put out there more EUAs around drugs and vaccines, even to the extent to which we're seeking them just for early assessment within the larger market. It has risks. You know those risks. You know it because of what FDA just did around approving the new drug in regards to Alzheimer's. The risks of putting a drug out there means you actually lose that capacity to actually test it thoroughly against the backdrop of control groups. But those risks may be ones that are willing to be played out when you've got real lives to save. The COVID-19 has shown us that some level of risk and experimentation around vaccines is worth it when we're literally saving tens of thousands of lives in the United States thanks to those developments. So, Rebecca, not to be too long-winded on that question, this is one of those slides that, gosh, we could have a whole presentation and webinar on just what to expect for future additions within the FDA legal arena. But some of it, at least hopefully, displayed neatly on screen. Great stuff, Rebecca. What else you see?
Yes, thank you, Professor Hodge. So another question that we have queued up for you. Mm-hmm. How do you know if you fall under the umbrella of liability protections in a real-time emergency event?
Rebecca, I'm telling you, for all of our audience, how do you know? Hey, you ask. You ask straight up. You flat out make sure that your legal counsel, whether you're working within a hospital setting, state or local government, whether you're being deployed through EMAC, the Emergency Management Systems Compact, whether you're coming at it through us specific arenas, you flat out ask. And listen, through our DHRS in Region 1, we've done some great documents and stuff that make this quite hopefully illustrative and beneficial. None of it constitutes legal advice, nor anything I've said constitutes it. But I'll tell you, if you can, working with your legal counsel, get that advanced determination, you fall within the umbrella of liability protection. So what you're not seeing on screen is something we work on consistently is all the different drop-downs, all the different ways in which you might be protected from ordinary acts of negligence. If you know it going in because of the placement of how you're deployed, or the efforts through telehealth or telemedicine that you're engaged in, or the specific facets of your own, you know, particular capacity as a healthcare worker, you should feel at least reasonably protected. Maybe you're trusting that your med mal carrier is going to protect you against any potential risk. Don't be so sure. Double check with them in advance. Super smart to do that. We've got some models for how that can be done as well. The important thing is you ask straight up. And once you get that feel or sense of what an existing liability protections may be there in your specific case, at least you may go forward knowing the ordinary acts of negligence that may have arisen that could have been acts of potential liability might be protected against claims. That's what you do. You ask straight up and you make sure of it going in. I hope that helps a little bit because I don't want anybody getting a sense that all you got to do is put your umbrella up and you're just golden. No, you ask, do you fit under the umbrella? And if so, then you should feel more confident about your next steps forward. Rebecca, great stuff. Go ahead. What else you see?
Yeah, so we have another question queued up for you. So if passed, how do you think COVID counterpunch legislation could impact or limit emergency response for events that we have no notice for? Or do you think this kind of legislation will be more relevant for lingering events like COVID-19?
You know, this legislation's gotten a lot of people very concerned, both obviously across multiple states, as Jim Pine and I have documented in some of our work, as well as within what you're seeing in the region. And keep in mind, as you know, Rebecca, we just looked at select examples. There's other bills out there, certainly in the region, that explore these specific themes. You know, this is where I say hold your horses a little bit. And the reason I'm saying that is because, you know, I'm seeing the state legislative responses. First of all, kind of recognize what you're also seeing on screen. A lot of these are going nowhere. They're introduced. They're not going to get through legislative committees. They're not going to be signed by the governor, and they're not going to survive a veto. Okay, so they're just threats, and they're idle threats as well. But they're politically driven by populations that do not want to feel the impact of that sort of serious level of public health interventions going forward. But for those bills that do sneak through, let's say each one of these somehow gets through those state houses and somehow the governors of each of our four states in the region sign these specific bills, which actually would be quite sensational because they actually limit what governors can do. But nevertheless, what does that mean? It means, remember, you're playing chess, not checkers. And what I'm really trying to convince, or at least sort of evince with that, is there are ways around several of those critical interventions you're seeing as demonstrated in this presentation. There are legal pathways around them. They may be through federal authorization or things that the feds could actually preempt or dictate. They could be waivers of existing state legislation in the next, you know, major event 5 years from now when we have another outbreak of something that's hopefully never as serious as COVID-19. I think the promise I'm trying to make is that what you're seeing in regards to the game of chess in response to COVID-19 is it's a brand new game. It's a game that involves a much serious and more extensive level of federal intervention than you ever will experience before. It's a game where you know the feds just can't lose again. You've got to actually, you know, control for what you're seeing with a major pandemic of this nature. Consequently, some of these initiatives that you're seeing, I think, even if passed, will not dictate fully what you can do in an emergency. But you must be conscientious of them, and you must be leery of them to the degree to which they might interfere with routine public health interventions. Those become more problematic because of what they may stop local health officials doing in real time in a non-emergency event. But honestly, I hope that gives a little bit of credence to that theory or theme that, listen, even though this legislation looks threatening, the game's changed. And the game is actually lending towards even stronger emergency response efforts down the road. Rebecca, I hope that helps a little bit. And no time is running short. Maybe one more question.
Yes, Professor Hodge, one more question for you. If you could please explain how the CARES Act protects volunteer healthcare workers.
Great point. And listen, it's one of those neat illustrations of how the federal government intervened in response to President Trump's signature of the CARES Act to actually address what was perceived as a real gap in relation to liability protections for all of those volunteers coming through federal or state-related interventions, all of which may have potentially seemingly been at risk in doing the things that we had to do experimentally or without full medical judgment in response to COVID-19 early on. And all medical doctors and nurses on with us, you all know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm deferential to those critical decisions. In fact, highly respectful of those. What Congress saw was a gap. It saw volunteers potentially at risk, even as they put their own lives and safety at line whether they're at risk for liability, Congress attempted through the CARES Act to clarify you will not be held liable for ordinary acts of negligence. You know, I thought that provision within the CARES Act was meaningful. And mind you, to be sure, as a political issue, it did have some impressions upon volunteers at every level. But honestly, I would have found them falling within that liability umbrella anyway. The ways in which they could have already fallen within this umbrella relate to issues around what you already have in federal volunteer health practitioner, federal volunteer health protections, yet state protections for volunteers. EMAC would have allowed for the deputization of those specific persons exchanged across states. Well, it was a neat intervention, and it did gain political favor with Congress, but to be sure replicated a lot of what was already underneath the umbrella of liability protections. Now, I know, and with special thanks to you, Rebecca, for monitoring all the questions and keeping us on track, that we're right about that point in time. I want to make sure we get a chance to turn it back over to our great colleague, Paul Bettinger. And without further ado, turn it back over to you, Paul, for any final comments or thoughts.
So, James, thank you so very much. That really was just an absolutely fantastic talk. And, you know, great review of the landscape. I think really intriguing look at what may be coming and some of the challenges that and successes, hopefully, that we will be looking at in the future. So, as always, we are so, so grateful for your involvement with us at the Region 1 RDHRS. Definitely want to thank you, thank Rebecca, thank your whole team for joining us. Again, for those who have attended, we will be posting a recording of this webinar on our website at rdhrs.org in just a little bit. Please feel free to refer this to your colleagues and friends who might be interested. We will also be looking for future other webinar topics, both on public health law related to disaster preparedness as well as other disaster topics. So please feel free to reach out to us at the email address you see here on your screen. If you have a topic you'd like us to consider tackling with one of our webinars, thank you to everyone for joining. Thanks again, James and Rebecca.
A real pleasure. Thank you, Rebecca, for your great monitoring of questions. Have a great afternoon, everyone. It's been a real pleasure. Take care.